We have already talked about slide 9, but let's quickly review what's happening here. Transcription has already ended, right? And transcription directly produces what's called the pre-mRNA because it is not yet in its final form, even though transcription has ended. So to get it in its final form, the pre-mRNA has to undergo post-transcriptional modification. Some of that's already been done on this top one. It's still pre-mRNA because it's not finalized yet, but what has already happened is that the 5' cap and the poly-A tail have been put on. And then the other major part of post-transcriptional modification is the removal of introns, which are not expressed, and the sewing together end-to-end of all the exons, which are expressed, and that's why they're called exons. That will lead to the final version, the so-called mature mRNA, although we usually just say mRNA rather than mature mRNA. So let's look at how this is done in slide 10. The removal of the introns and the sewing together of the exons that I was talking about is called many different kinds of RNA, though. Here we see a different kind of RNA called small nuclear ribonucleic acid, or snRNA. When you complex snRNA, as you see the red strand, with protein, that makes up a small nuclear ribonucleoprotein, so-called because it's partly nucleic acid and partly protein. All right, that will make up a SNRP. Multiple SNRPs plus tens of other proteins complex together to make this overall molecular machine that we call the spliceosome. And the spliceosome's job is to recognize the beginning and end of each intron within the pre-mRNA transcript, make cuts at the beginning and end of each intron, take the introns out, they are excised or cut out, and you can see this one has been cut out, and then hook the two exons that were on either side of that intron together, end to end. That's why it's called splicing. It's kind of like splicing a film. You take a frame or two out that are damaged and hook the others together. The intron that's been cut out, or all of the introns get cut out, but there's one shown here. And a cutout intron is, of course, no longer part of the mRNA, and by definition of being an intron, it's not going to be used in translation. It is not completely worthless, though, because it's valuable as a source of nucleotides. So the introns that get cut out will be digested in the cell into individual RNA nucleotides, which just become part of the overall RNA nucleotide pool in the cell. And so they might, the next moment, be part of some other kind of RNA, or including mRNA, but any other kind of RNA. Okay, the exons, though, get put together by the spliceosome. And then you finally have the mature mRNA, which is, by mature, I mean ready to go on to the next major part of gene expression, which is translation. Now, in slide 11, we can see what exons correspond to. That top part is DNA, as you see, and strictly speaking, introns and exons are part of mRNA, not DNA. But we often use the words to refer to the corresponding parts in DNA, right? Anything in mRNA has a corresponding part in DNA because that's how you make the mRNA, by reading the DNA. Really, though, it's better to call the mRNA parts exons and introns. Anyway, we're looking at a gene here, just a very simple gene with three exons and two introns. And notice the color coding. Of course, the introns get spliced out. That's what we were just talking about. So they're not used to specify amino acids in translation, so they don't really affect the protein. But you have the polypeptide shown here, or the protein, the single polypeptide protein on the bottom that is the gene product. This is a protein-coding gene, and the gene product is the ultimate result. But by the color coding, you can see that each individual exon corresponds to a part, just a part, of the polypeptide called a domain. So a domain is not a molecule. A domain is just part of the molecule, but specifically part of the polypeptide that's built once the messenger RNA goes on to be translated. And domains are a little bit like functional groups, except involving many more atoms, right? We've explained why functional groups get their name, things like carboxyl, hydroxyl, you know, the functional groups we've talked about. Those small collections of atoms called functional groups are called functional groups because by being part of a bigger molecule, those functional groups give that molecule specific functions because of their chemical properties. Similarly, domains, which are some subsequence of the overall polypeptide sequence, give the overall polypeptide some sort of function because of the specific amino acids that domain is made out of. All right, so a domain is not the entire polypeptide, just part of it, and it gives a certain shape to that region of the polypeptide, and therefore a certain function, because function is based on shape. Now, let me see. You don't really see a good picture of this, but while I'm still on slide 11, let me say that there is such a thing as alternative mRNA splicing. What you see here is not really indicating that, but alternative mRNA splicing refers to the fact that a single gene can actually end up coding for multiple polypeptides. Based on how I've described things, you wouldn't think that's true, because what I said is that introns get removed and all the exons get sewn together. That's a possibility. But alternative mRNA splicing means that depending on the condition, only some but not all of the exons get included in the final version of mRNA. In other words, some exons can be skipped just like introns are skipped. And therefore, only certain domains appear in the final product. You see how that results in one gene coding for multiple different polypeptides? It just depends on which exons get included in the final version of the mRNA. In other words, pre-mRNA is the same for any given gene. Each time it's transcribed, you're going to make the same pre-mRNA. So it codes for only, the gene codes for only one pre-mRNA. But then after transcription, that mRNA can be alternatively spliced, leading to multiple different mature mRNAs, each of which specifies at least slightly different polypeptide. And this really increases the efficiency of the genome, meaning that you can have a family of functionally related proteins. For instance, this is just an example. There are things called isozymes. Isozymes are enzymes doing the same job, so they're there for the same purpose, but each isozyme is slightly different. It's a slightly different protein compared to the other isozymes. For instance, a cell might make different versions of an enzyme that operate best at different temperatures, and it will make the one that works best at the temperature that the cell is at. Doing that requires making, you know, having a different sequence of amino acids, a different primary structure. Well, you could accomplish this by having a separate gene in the DNA coding for each of the different versions, right? Each of the different isozymes. That's one way of doing it. But if they're largely the same and differ maybe in just one domain, all the rest of the polypeptide would be the same. Then if you had different genes specifying each of these different slight variations, then each of the different genes would be almost the same, right? They would only differ in a sequence that corresponds to the domain that differs. Is all this making sense? If you don't want to include domain 3, for instance, in here, then if you had a whole separate gene coding for just the polypeptide that includes domains 1 and 2, then it would be just like this gene except for exon 3. And so you'd be duplicating a bunch of stuff. Whereas if you may have one master gene for all of the isozymes, which share a lot of their structure, but just differ in one or two domains, then you can save a lot of DNA. You can make the genome more efficient by just alternatively splicing the pre-mRNA that one gene makes, and depending on which exons get included and which ones get excluded, which depends on the conditions, then you'll make the different versions of the isozymes from that same gene.
Okay, so if you could have just a domain 1, just a domain 2, just a domain 3, but sometimes you can have all three.
Yes, or just domain 1 and 3. It just depends on which exons get excluded in the post-transcriptional modification, the splicing. And that's why it's called alternative splicing, because you can do it, you can use the same pre-mRNA and splice it differently depending on conditions. Yeah?
So the splices all stuff happens in RNA processing, right?
It's not only RNA processing, it's mRNA processing, and it's not only mRNA processing, it's post-transcriptional modification. So it's post-transcriptional processing. It doesn't happen until after transcription is done, though, is the point, is what I'm saying.
Before translation?
Yeah, the whole idea is to... the whole idea behind alternative gene splice or alternative mRNA splicing is to be able to create different mRNAs, each of which can then go on to translation. You know, once you have the mRNA finalized, then you're going to end up making only that one type of polypeptide. But by alternatively splicing, you can end up making multiple different versions of mRNA, which then go on to make different versions of the polypeptides. All right, let's go to 12 now. We're done with post-transcriptional modification, and the next major step in gene expression is translation. So what is the major goal of translation? Yes, translation is when the polypeptide finally gets built. Up to that point, you've just been dealing with codes for how to build a polypeptide, and those codes were originally in the form of DNA, then in RNA, and that RNA has been processed. That's where we are in the overall gene expression process. We finally have a mature mRNA, and now what do you do with it? Well, in order to build a polypeptide, you need to read that code that the messenger RNA is. That's what the transcript is, a code for how to build a polypeptide, one amino acid at a time. And doing that requires something to do the work of assembling the polypeptide. And that involves another molecular machine, the one in brown, which is a ribosome. And we're going to talk about some more kinds of RNA. We've already talked about messenger RNA and small nuclear RNA. There are many other kinds of RNA. We're not going to go through all of them in this course, but we're going to mention a couple more in the process of translation. Speaking of witches, the ribosome itself includes some RNA. You don't see the detail here. All you see here is what I've already told you about ribosomes, namely that a given ribosome is made of two subunits, a small subunit and a large subunit. But what you don't see from this picture is that the subunits are mixtures, molecularly speaking. The subunits are made out of protein and RNA, kind of like a SNRP is, but this is using different proteins and different RNA. The type of RNA that's part of the ribosomal complexes is called ribosomal RNA. So that's a third type of RNA that we've mentioned, or just for short, rRNA, small rRNA. All right, that's just part of the brown molecular machine that you're seeing here. And while we're on the topic of that, the translation process is going to involve enzymatic activity. That shouldn't come as a surprise, right? We're building a polymer. It should include some enzymatic activity. Well, this brings up the fact that for a long time, biologists thought that all biological catalysts were proteins. And what do we call those biological catalysts? Biological catalysts. What are biological catalysts?
Enzymes.
Enzymes, yes. Well, it is true that all enzymes are proteins. But we kind of invented that word enzyme with the thinking that turned out to be incorrect, that all biological catalysts are proteins. Well, it is true that all enzymes are proteins because that's what we use the name for. But then we learned later that some sorts of RNA have catalytic activity. And we don't call those enzymes because enzymes already means a protein acting as an enzyme. I mean, acting as a catalyst. So we invented another word, ribozyme. A ribozyme is an RNA that acts as a catalyst. And that includes, I mean, they're called ribozymes because ribosomes have ribosomal RNA in it that has catalytic activity. All right? So that's in the brown thing. Now, the ribosome, which is the brown thing, I've told you this before, is not complete, meaning both of the subunits are not together when they are the only thing there. The ribosomal subunits do not come together until and unless a messenger RNA molecule first binds to a small subunit that's just on its own. And we'll see a picture of this in a minute. And that's why I told you back in the tour of the cell chapter when we first looked at ribosomes that the picture was a lie, because it showed you a picture of a ribosome just by itself with both subunits together. That doesn't happen. In the cell, before translation begins, There are just many copies of large subunits, all interchangeable. They're identical. And a bunch of copies of small subunits, all identical, not interacting with each other. Once the messenger RNA comes along and binds to one of those small subunits, then the large subunit comes along and completes the thing. And that's already been done here. But the job of the ribosome is to read the code that the messenger RNA transcript contains. We've already talked about the fact that that code exists in three-letter sequences, each of which is called a codon, right? We talked about the fact that you have to have a sequence of three nucleotides to specify an amino acid, because you have to specify 20 different amino acids, and there are only four kinds of nitrogenous bases, four kinds of RNA nucleotides. So that's why there are 64 codons. Well, each codon specifies an amino acid, and therefore a ribosome needs to read the mRNA one codon at a time. And this brings up yet another kind of RNA. The teal-colored bent rods that you see in the cartoon version are tRNAs, which is short for transfer RNA. So transfer RNAs are really important in the process of translation, because they ensure the integrity of the information. What I mean by that is that if you're going to build the proper polypeptide, then you need to be sure that when you read a codon in the messenger RNA, which specifies exactly one amino acid, right, because of non-ambiguity of the genetic code, when you read that codon, you better be sure that only that amino acid that the codon specifies gets allowed to be added next to the growing chain of amino acids, the growing polypeptide, in other words. And it's tRNA's job to make sure that that happens, to make sure that the incorrect or an incorrect amino acid does not come in when a codon gets read. We can talk more about this in a minute, but a transfer RNA, a single tRNA, exists in two major forms. Notice the one on the left here that seems to be leaving or is leaving the ribosome. It is not carrying any amino acid. These purple things are amino acids individually. So this tRNA is in one of the possible forms. It is a so-called uncharged tRNA. And that doesn't have anything to do with electrical charge. For a tRNA to be charged means that it is carrying at least one amino acid. So the two major categories of tRNA at any given moment are uncharged and charged. This one is uncharged because it's not carrying any amino acid. If a tRNA is charged, that statement by itself simply means that that tRNA is connected to at least one amino acid. But there's two possibilities of that, both of which we see in this picture. This one on the right that's coming into the ribosome is a tRNA that's connected to exactly one amino acid. Happens to be glycine in this example, but it could be any of the 20. As long as the tRNA is charged and connected to only one amino acid, then we call that, let me get a darker color, we call that tRNA an aminoacyl tRNA. That's what this one is, for instance. These two are as well. Each one is carrying just one amino acid. So that's one way that a tRNA can be charged. Notice this one in the middle, though. It's connected directly to only one amino acid, but the amino acid it's connected to is part of a string of amino acids. In other words, a peptide, right? A peptide of some length. Could be a bipeptide, a tripeptide, an oligopeptide, or a polypeptide, just depending on how many there are. But it's more than one. That's the point. And if a tRNA is charged, but charged with more than one amino acid, then it's not called an aminoacyl tRNA, it's called a peptidyl tRNA. Those are the two types of charged tRNA. So there's really three possibilities overall: uncharged tRNA, aminoacyl tRNA, and peptidyl tRNA. I'll use a different slide to talk about that. So let's go on to 13 and look at a tRNA molecule. tRNA, of course, is RNA. And you're already used to, hopefully, thinking of RNA as being a single strand, whereas DNA is a double strand, right? That's true. A tRNA is one strand, so you see a 5' end and a 3' end. But it's not just a stretched out linear strand. It folds back on itself, which is why parts of it look like it's two strands, but it's the same strand just wrapping back on itself. And because of the sequence it has, parts of the same RNA are complementary to each other. And it folds up into this, if you flatten it, it doesn't have this shape, but if you flatten it out, the three-dimensional shape is shown right here. If you flatten it out into one plane, then it has this so-called cloverleaf shape with three hairpin loops. And of course, the entire RNA is a sequence of AUs, Cs, and Gs, just like any RNA is. So you can see letters along the whole length. But this middle of the three loops of the clover leaf has a three nucleotide sequence associated with it that are particularly important. This three-letter sequence, or triplet, is called the anticodon. And the reason it's called the anticodon is that that particular sequence is complementary to, that's what the anti refers here, it's complementary to a specific codon. Now think back to the genetic code. The genetic code lists all 64 codons, but remember, three of those are used as stop codons. So there are really only 61 codons that specify amino acids, right? Well, each of those 61 codons, if you use the rules of complementarity, has a complementary sequence to it. And that's what an anticodon is, a sequence that is complementary to a codon. Well, just as there are different codons in the genetic code that specify different amino acids, there are different types of tRNA. It's not just that there's many, many copies of tRNA that are all the same. There are different categories of tRNA, each of which occurs in many, many copies. There have to be different versions of tRNA because for tRNA to do its job of ensuring that only the right amino acid comes in next, it has to be the case that each tRNA is allowed to carry only one kind of amino acid. Otherwise, you could end up bringing in the wrong one. And what ensures that only the correct type of tRNA comes in to the ribosome when a codon is being read, the tRNA has to have the right anticodon to match up complementarily to the codon that is being read at the ribosome. We can see this temporarily if I go back to slide 12. Notice the codon GGC is the one that's currently being read. Well, complementary to that is CCG. And only a kind of tRNA that has that anticodon is allowed in there because of complementarity. The other kinds of tRNA will not be able to get in. They don't have the right anticodon. Okay? And any tRNA that has this anticodon, which is complementary to GGC, is allowed to carry only glycine. Because when you look up GGC, the codon in the genetic code, it corresponds to glycine. That's how the integrity of the information is maintained. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's why you have to have a bunch of different kinds of tRNA, each category of tRNA has a different anticodon recognizing a different codon.
And then they just come in.
But each kind of tRNA with its anticodon matching up to a codon is able to carry only the kind of amino acid that corresponds to that codon in the genetic code.
Codons that are in that specific mRNA, or
no? There's 61 possibilities, there's 64 total possibilities, right? But three of them are not amino acid specifying. Three of them are stop codons.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's only 61 possible ones for any protein that's being built, for any mRNA, and an mRNA is simply some specific sequence of codons, each of which has a choice of 61 possibilities. Yeah.
So is every CCG going to be amino acid?
CCG is not. You mean each CCG tRNA?
Yeah.
Any tRNA is going to be either uncharged, amino acyl, or peptidyl at different times.
Yeah.
So these are not permanent categories. Every different type of tRNA is going to go through all three forms: uncharged, charged with one amino acid or amino acyl, and charged with multiple amino acids or peptidyl.
So
it's just going to, and this one that you see leaving here at the left end, it already went through the other two. It's this one earlier. Yes, every individual tRNA is going to go through a period of being charged with one, charged with several, and charged with none, or uncharged.
Oh, okay.
Over and over. And we'll see the details of that in a minute. But back to slide 13 where we're looking at the tRNA. The anticodon is so important because of that. The anticodon determines what specific kind of amino acid this particular tRNA molecule is allowed to carry. The only amino acid that it is ever going to be allowed to carry is the amino acid that corresponds in the genetic code to an mRNA codon that is complementary to this tRNA's anticodon. That's why it doesn't get mixed up. That's why the integrity of the information is intact. Now, in order to carry an amino acid, in other words, for a tRNA to be charged, it has to connect it. And the 3' end of the tRNA is the place where an amino acid can be attached. And I stress the word can there because it doesn't have to be attached, right? A tRNA can be uncharged, like this one is at the moment. There's nothing attached to it. But when it becomes charged, the amino acid that it's allowed to carry will be attached to the 3' end, represented in slide 12 by the little black line hanging off. Okay, that's the 3' end. That's where it carries the amino acid. Okay, now to 14. So what we have in the cell is a bunch of different copies, identical copies, of each of the different kinds of tRNA. And by different kinds, I mean each different kind has a different anticodon, and therefore each different kind is able to carry a different kind of amino acid, but only that kind of amino acid. Those make up the overall tRNA pool. All the different kinds are there all the time in the cell. But in order for a tRNA to be used in translation, in other words, in order for it to do its job of bringing in the next proper amino acid to be added to the polypeptide, the tRNA first has to be charged with that amino acid. It starts out as an uncharged tRNA. You have to put on the proper type of amino acid that that particular kind of tRNA is able to carry, is allowed to carry. And that is controlled and allowed to happen with the help of an enzyme. The grayish thing here that kind of looks like a human embryo is an enzyme. And notice that its name is aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is not aminoacyl tRNA. Aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is an enzyme responsible for charging an uncharged tRNA with one amino acid. In other words, turning that uncharged tRNA into an aminoacyl tRNA. And the synthetase name indicates that it's bringing things together. Syn means together. So the two things that it brings together is an uncharged tRNA and the particular kind of amino acid that that kind of tRNA is allowed to carry. Now, there's not just one kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Just like there are different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA, each able to carry its own kind of amino acid, there are also different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase that work on just one kind of tRNA. Is that all straight? Okay, this is showing one of them. And notice the pretty complex active site here. The active site, part of the active site, allows for this particular aminoacyl tRNA synthetase, allows just one type of amino acid into part of that active site. So to complete the job, you better make sure that only the kind of tRNA that's allowed to carry that amino acid can come into the rest of the active site. The reason the enzyme ensures that is because this part, this flat part of the active site in this cartoon, is able to recognize a specific anticodon, and only a kind of tRNA that has that anticodon will fit into the active site and then get hitched to the amino acid. So the synthetase enzyme ensures that each uncharged tRNA will be charged with its correct kind of amino acid. You have all the different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzymes working simultaneously, but each kind is charging its own specific kind of tRNA.
What do you think the effects of tRNA?
Well, those don't occur until the ribosome is involved. So here we're talking about before translation can occur, just in the general pool of tRNA molecules. Some of them are uncharged, and they need this enzyme's help to get charged, but the enzyme will only put one amino acid onto them, making only aminoacyl tRNAs. so that the cell will always have all of the different kinds of tRNA, aminoacyl tRNAs, each carrying one amino acid, available in case their codon gets called up at the ribosome so that they can go over there and deliver that one kind of amino acid next. So the pool of aminoacyl tRNAs means there's always every type of amino acid being carried by a tRNA in case that amino acid's codon gets specified at the ribosome. The codon gets read. That's what these synthetase molecules do. They ensure that there's all of these kinds of aminoacyl tRNAs available. Okay, now, in 15, we're concentrating on the ribosome. So all of these aminoacyl tRNAs are in the pool. They're available to the cell. Now let's talk about actual translation involving the ribosome, of course. The top view doesn't really show you much useful information. It's kind of the shape of it, but the cartoon version is much easier to look at. Notice that the ribosome has three slots associated with it, which you probably read as EPA because in English we read left to right, but it's the reverse order in which these slots get used. A first, then P, then E. And these are not just random letters. They stand for something, as you see. The A slot is short for the aminoacyl tRNA binding site, because that's where, one at a time, an aminoacyl tRNA carrying its specific kind of amino acid is going to come in, bringing that one amino acid in so that it can be added to the growing chain. All right? That's the incoming end of the ribosome, basically. The P slot is short for the peptidyl tRNA binding site. And notice on the bottom figure, this tRNA that's in the P slot is a peptidyl tRNA at the moment because it's carrying multiple amino acids, not just one. That's what makes it a peptidyl tRNA. And the E slot is short for exit, the exit slot, or you could also think of it as an ejection slot, because the now empty or uncharged tRNA occupying the exit slot gets ejected. So tRNAs come in at the A slot, but then as translation proceeds, this whole translation complex, meaning the ribosome and the mRNA, shifts, or more correctly, the ribosome shifts with respect to the mRNA, kind of like film being strung through a projector one frame at a time. The film is like the mRNA here. The mRNA shifts with respect to the ribosome one codon at a time. So when that happens, the tRNA that's in the A slot is in the next moment going to find itself in the P slot and then finally in the E slot and then be ejected. And this is what I was referring to when I said that any given tRNA is going to exist as an aminoacyl tRNA, then as a peptidyl tRNA, then as an uncharged tRNA. The aminoacyl tRNA that's in the A slot right here, of course, is carrying just a single amino acid. That's what makes it an aminoacyl tRNA. The one in the middle is carrying, in this example, four. But when this new aminoacyl tRNA comes into the A slot, then these four amino acids on the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot are going to be moved from the peptidyl tRNA that's carrying them to the amino acid being carried by the aminoacyl tRNA. Okay, these four are going to go on to this one that's being carried in the A slot. When that happens, then even though it's the A slot, this tRNA will be carrying five amino acids, right? And therefore, that's going to make this a peptidyl tRNA. And these four are no longer on this tRNA, so that's going to make this middle tRNA uncharged. Is that all clear, according to the definitions? And then when everything shifts by one codon, that now uncharged tRNA is going to be in the exit slot, and it will be removed. That's like this one. The one that will be carrying 5 and is in the A slot will then be in the P slot, which is where a peptidyl tRNA should be, right? And that's going to leave an empty A slot that's reading the next codon, allowing for the next correct type of aminoacyl tRNA to come into the A slot. And that's why each different kind of tRNA needs its own anticodon, because the only kind of aminoacyl tRNA that's going to be allowed to come into that empty A slot once it shifts is a kind of tRNA that whose anticodon is perfectly complementary to the codon. Is this making sense?
Yeah. So which way is the mRNA moving? Is it going like closer to the 5' or closer to the 3'?
It's relative. You could say the mRNA is moving or the ribosome is moving. But if you say the mRNA in this picture is moving, it's moving toward the left, and the ribosome.
So it starts at the 5'?
Yes. Yeah, there's only one way that you can become a peptidyl tRNA, and that's at a ribosome, by receiving an amino acid or more from a tRNA that has already been in the ribosome for one round. And we'll see the picture of this in a minute. No, this one that's a peptidyl tRNA is started out as an aminoacyl tRNA and came in here. And then it received, in this case, this one with 4 received 3 from the previous one. The one before that received 2 from its previous one. And the one before that received 1 from its previous one.
So were they all peptidyls?
Yeah, until you finally hit a stop codon. But they're only peptidyl tRNAs while they're on the ribosome, because they will just pass that peptide, however long it is, to the next incoming aminoacyl tRNA, making it into a peptidyl tRNA, but only while it's still connected to the ribosome. Once they pass that peptide to the next one, then they become uncharged, like this one, find themselves in the E slot, and then leave. That's when they have to go meet up with the correct kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase to recharge them with another version of that same kind of amino acid that they're allowed to carry.
So, could you ever have one, like just the single one that?
Yeah, that's how they all start. That's what the aminoacyl tRNA synthetases are doing.
But they don't stay like that.
They don't stay like that on the ribosome. They do out in the cytosol.
Okay.
I mean, the ribosome is in the cytosol too, but I'm talking about away from the ribosome. They are either uncharged because they haven't met up with their synthetase yet, or they are charged with that one kind of amino acid they're allowed to carry. That's the pool. All kinds of amino acids, each being carried by one tRNA, are available. And when the codon specifying that amino acid comes up to the A slot next, empty A slot, then only that kind of tRNA carrying that amino acid can come in there, because only that kind of tRNA has the anticodon complementary to the codon. Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at this overall process now, starting with slide 16. Think back, though, first, even we're looking at translation here, but think back to transcription, which we've already covered. What were the names of the 3 major phases of transcription? That's right. Initiation, elongation, and termination. Well, translation, which is an entirely different process and therefore has different things happening in it compared to transcription, also occurs in three phases that have those same exact names. So translation occurs as initiation, then elongation, then termination as well. 16 shows you initiation of translation. Here's where you see what I was telling you earlier today. A ribosome is not hooked together, both subunits hooked together, until first a small ribosomal subunit, any one of the many, many identical copies in the cell, binds to a messenger RNA transcript. So this is the mature mRNA transcript in red. This is a small ribosomal subunit, and those two meet up. And notice that there is a so-called mRNA binding site on the small ribosomal subunit. Well, remember we were talking about untranslated regions of the mRNA? Upstream of the first, upstream of the start codon, you have untranslated regions. Well, those aren't worthless. Those allow for binding to this binding site. But they're untranslated because those aren't going to be read as codons. That's just the part of the mRNA that allows it to bind to the small ribosomal subunit. And when that happens, it will place the start codon itself, which is that AUG one, right into what eventually will be, once the other subunit comes along, the P slot, not the A slot. Okay, so the start codon gets centered on the P slot. And also before the large subunit comes along, which really has the P slot on it, the particular kind of tRNA that has just the right anticodon to correspond to AUG, the start codon, in other words, the tRNA that has UAC as its anticodon, which is complementary to AUG, right? That particular kind of tRNA, hydrogen bonds via its nitrogenous bases to the start codon. And of course, any tRNA that has UAC as its anticodon is allowed to carry only the kind of amino acid that AUG specifies in the genetic code, which is methionine. That's why I said that since the start codon does double duty as a start codon and as a specifier of methionine, all polypeptides start out as with methionine as the first amino acid. It's carrying methionine, because methionine corresponds to AUG. All right? This making sense? Still not complete yet. We only have half a ribosome here, but we have some other components as well. Well, then you have to spend some energy. That's what this GTP molecule is for. We're used to thinking of nucleoside triphosphates as energy-carrying molecules, right? But usually it's ATP, as we've talked about in other chapters. ATP is just one kind of nucleoside triphosphate, though, right? It's the most versatile type, which is why it's used in so many different energy-requiring applications. But not all. GTP is also carrying a lot of energy, just like ATP is, but GTP is guanosine triphosphate. So the nucleoside that's part of it is guanosine, meaning guanine and a sugar, guanine and ribose. That's guanosine, and then three phosphates. Just like ATP gets used by, the energy in ATP gets used by cleaving off a phosphate, same thing happens here. GTP gets dephosphorylated into GDP and an inorganic phosphate. That releases energy, and hopefully it makes sense to you that energy is required in this process of translation because we're undergoing an anabolic process, right? We're building a big polymer out of small subunits. So it's going to be expensive. And just initiation, which just forms this complex to begin with so the rest can happen, already spends some energy. But when you spend that GTP, then the large ribosomal subunit comes along and binds to the rest of it. That's when you really have your slots in place, full slots. And this whole thing, the mRNA, the two ribosomal subunits, and the aminoacyl tRNA carrying methionine, together, those things are all called the translation initiation complex. So that's the first part. That's initiation. Let's go to 17 and look at elongation. Well, it's called elongation for the same reason that elongation in transcription is called that. Something gets added to a longer and longer strand, right? But in this case, it's not a nucleic acid that's being built like it was in transcription. Now you're building a polymer made out of amino acids. In other words, a polypeptide is being built. That's the elongation. And we're looking at this already a few steps after initiation. So some elongation has already occurred here. But notice that elongation is a cycle, meaning that these same steps shown here will be taken over and over for as many codons as there are in the messenger RNA transcript before you get to a stop codon. So elongation just continues one codon at a time for any of the 61 codons that specify amino acids. The 61 amino acid specifying codons are all the ones except the stop codons. Right? So what I mean is this cycle is indefinite. It depends on how big the messenger RNA is. Some polypeptides are thousands of amino acids long, so it's going to go through elongation a lot of times, but it will keep undergoing elongation as long as the codon is not a stop codon, that the next codon being read is not a stop codon. All right, but you can see that some of this has already happened because this tRNA that's in the P slot is already carrying 4. And this A slot is open, and it's reading the next codon, whatever it is. It can correspond to any of the 20 amino acids, right? It can be any of the 61 amino acid specifying codons. But this is where the anticodon is important, because only a tRNA whose anticodon is complementary to that codon will be allowed into the A slot. And therefore, only that kind of amino acid will come in. You see that happening, but notice right after that tRNA comes in, then more GTP has to be spent to transfer the peptide that the middle one is carrying, the peptidyl tRNA. This is 4, but it depends how many times it's happened. However many amino acids are in the peptide being carried by the peptidyl tRNA are then shifted from that peptidyl tRNA to the aminoacyl tRNA's amino acid. So now this one that's in the A slot at the moment is no longer going to be an aminoacyl tRNA, right? It's going to be carrying all 5 of them. So this is a peptidyl tRNA once that happens, and this one's now empty, so it's now an uncharged tRNA. So for the moment, they're in their wrong slot as far as what the slots are named for. But that's going to change because things are going to shift. Anyway, you see these 4 having been transferred to the 1 right here. This now is a peptidyl tRNA. This is an uncharged tRNA. Then to make that shift happen, you have to spend more GTP. And now the peptidyl tRNA that was in the A slot is in the P slot for which it's named. And the one that already shifted all of its amino acids to the other one is an uncharged TNA in the E slot, and it gets ejected. This ejected one, this uncharged tRNA, is now going to go find the right kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzyme to give it another copy of the amino acid that it's allowed to carry. So it can go another round once that same codon gets called up again. Okay, now there are 2 GTPs being spent here in elongation for each additional amino acid. So if you have a typical polypeptide, which could be hundreds or thousands of amino acids long, you're going to spend a lot of GTP to make it. By That shouldn't surprise you because of what we said about energetic processes. That's elongation, and that brings us finally to 18, which is termination. What defines termination is that the currently read codon that comes up next in the A slot, in the empty A slot, is going to be any one of the three stop codons. If it's any of the other codons, then it will specify an amino acid and therefore it will be part of elongation. But if any one of the three stop codons come up, and those are the UAG, UAA, or UGA, it doesn't matter which one, then there is not going to be any kind of tRNA coming in. The stop codons don't do double duty like the start codon does. Each stop codon is only a stop codon. It doesn't specify an amino acid, and therefore there's no such thing as a tRNA that has an anticodon complementary to any of these three stop codons. So it's not a tRNA that comes into the A slot when the A slot is reading a stop codon. Instead, it's this yellow thing, which is a protein instead of a tRNA. And that protein is called a release factor. Once again, factor meaning protein. And when the release factor comes in, that really is what tells the ribosome the amino acid that you just added in the last elongation step, that's the last one needed. We've reached the end of the messenger RNA code, and so it's time to disassemble this translation complex. And that's what happens. The sequence of amino acids, however many, which depends on how many codons there were before the stop codon, that is being carried by the peptidyl tRNA at the moment, gets released from the peptidyl tRNA, and so now this is an uncharged tRNA, and that gets ejected. The polypeptide is on its own. The free polypeptide, free means it's on its own. The release factor, the two ribosomal subunits and the messenger RNA that are kind of clamped together also are going to disassemble, but first another GTP has to be spent. Okay, so you have to spend a GTP for initiation. You have to spend two GTP for each amino acid during elongation, and then you have to spend a final GTP to disassemble the complex. Translation is complete at this point, but although this translation complex has disintegrated, of course the polypeptide has not disintegrated, right? That would be completely counterproductive. You went to the bother of producing a specific polypeptide with a specific sequence. It doesn't get disintegrated into amino acids. It stays as a polypeptide. It's just no longer connected to tRNA. And also importantly, the messenger RNA is still intact. It's just not associated with the ribosome anymore. The reason I say this is important is that although this translation complex has been disintegrated, that particular mRNA transcript can be reused and will be reused as long as it exists. Meaning that the whole thing can start over again. A small ribosomal subunit can come along and bind to that mRNA, creating a new translation initiation complex. It can go through elongation and termination again and produce another copy, identical copy, of this polypeptide. So don't think that an mRNA gets used just to make one copy of a polypeptide. There are many, many copies of the polypeptide that a single mRNA will end up coding for. But they're all identical because it's the same code being used over and over. Kind of like using a photocopier to make hundreds or thousands of identical copies of the original. Now, the reason this is important is because the whole intent of this translation process, or even more generally the gene expression process, is to produce polypeptides. So that whatever is happening in the cell, at the moment, it needs whatever this polypeptide is. That's why the gene was turned on and expressed and gone through, and that's why transcription and translation occurred, so that the cell now has that polypeptide, right? But eventually it will have enough of that polypeptide. Well, as long as the messenger RNA transcript is still there, more and more of that polypeptide will be produced, right? And eventually that will be inappropriate. You don't want to keep making polypeptide after it's no longer needed or when you already have enough. And this is why messenger RNA transcripts do not hang around forever. They'll be used multiple times in translation to create multiple copies of a polypeptide they code for. But eventually, a messenger RNA transcript gets digested into individual RNA nucleotides and then recycled. Digesting it into RNA nucleotides is going to destroy the information it's carrying, so it can no longer be translated, right? And therefore, no more polypeptides of that type are built from that transcript. Now, you lose all that information it's carrying, but that's no big deal, right? Why is it no big deal?
There's more DNA.
Right, because if the next moment you need that polypeptide again, you just go back to the library, the DNA, turn that gene on again, transcribe it into a fresh copy of mRNA that's exactly like the one that was destroyed previously. And so that will end up making exactly the same kind of polypeptide again when it gets translated, if it does. That is kind of a shift in gears, so I'm going to stop there. A little early today.